Are you not entertained?
Hello and welcome to History in Technicolor with me, Wolf O'Neill, and someone taking a drink.
Me, David Crowther, just coming off mute.
David, what have we picked for everyone today?
Well, it's interesting you should ask me that, Wolf, because we have decided to do those deeply historical analytical movies, The Life of Brian and The Holy Grail.
Fascinating. Looking forward to this. It was a pretty fun research period. So, David, when did you first become a fan of the Pythons?
Well, I came late to the Pythons, Wolf, because I thought they were really rubbish. And I really didn't like the sketch shows, and I thought all the surrealism was a bit daft. And I didn't find the picture of a bloke with a hanky on his head sitting at a desk in the sea saying enough, something completely different, even remotely amusing. So I came late to the Pythons because Dan Thorley and I, Dan was in fact called Ian, but we called him Dan. I've no idea why.
Sounds like a Python sketch.
It does in fact sound like a Python sketch. I did ask him and he said, I don't know really. Anyway, so we went to the Odeon in Loughborough, I think, to see Life of Brian. I think we had to sneak in, because I think it was 18. I'm not sure. Or maybe that was Flesh Gordon. Anyway, moving on.
We once found all the Flesh Gordon movies in a charity shop on video.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right? We didn't get into that one, has to be said. They said they'd let me in, but not my weedy mates. Anyway, obviously, I was very glad I wasn't allowed into that. Shall I move on?
Yes.
So I went to see Life of Brian, and I have never laughed so much before or since. The entire auditorium, and people don't laugh in Loughborough by and large, the entire auditorium were rolling around in the aisles. Everybody absolutely lost it in a way I've never seen before or since. And that was 1979, of course, or I think so. So that was where it started. And then I went back and looked at some of the sketches and that sort of thing. How's about you, Wolf? Because you're a younger man than I am.
Yeah, so I think I was somewhere around 15 years old, and one of my friends, Mike Spencer, I think, had a DVD copy of The Holy Grail and was raving about it. Must have been influenced by his dad. And I remember we all put it on, and it immediately became the greatest thing we had ever seen. Rushed to show it to everyone, take it to as many sleepovers as possible. And then immediately it was into Life of Brian, to a lesser extent. What's the last one? What's the third one?
The Meaning of Life.
Yes.
Which has one fantastic line in it. But apart from that, I didn't particularly take to it. It was kind of all right, but it was kind of a sketch show, wasn't it?
Yeah. So then obviously we went through and then we started watching, had the DVD of the like greatest hits collection of the Flying Circus. So yeah, to be honest, and then ever since it was, and then it would like follow their individual careers. So watched a lot of Terry Gilliam movies. Yeah, just hooked immediately, fans ever since.
Okay, so I've got two things to say. First of all, the greatest line in The Meaning of Life was...
Are you talking about the wafer thin mint?
Not quite, actually. I prefer the line before that when he goes into the restaurant. It is Mr. Creosote, though. He goes into the restaurant and he says, I'll have a menu and a bucket. And I think that's a more an immortal line, which I have been tempted to use so much. And it's so hard to go into a restaurant and not use that line. So hard. And then the second thing was that I have a theory mm-hmm. about Monty Python sketch shows, all right?
Mm-hmm.
My theory is that they are a good deal better in the repeating than they are in the original. So I think I watched the National Cheese Emporium sketch in complete silence. But when I went down to the pub later, we howled. Repeating.
Interesting.
And that's what we did at school. You know, we went to school and repeated all these sketches and found it incredibly funny. And all through my life, you know, like that. There's a Not the 9 o'clock News sketch where they say, when three of us are gathered together, we shall perform the parrot sketch. And that's kind of like what it's like.
Yeah, I in preparation for this, I watched a few of the sketches. Most of them I still remember. But I also think sometimes they're better in my memory than they are when I watch them.
Yes.
I rewatched The Priest and I went in like, yes. And it was still pretty funny, but it wasn't quite what I remembered. It just becomes something different in my mind.
Yeah. I think that's, yeah, I mean, I don't know what it is, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that they're clever, but surreal. And therefore, when you talk about them, when you make them funnier by your enjoyment of them. And I think, anyway, it's a general rule in life, it seems to me, that other people's enthusiasms help you see the beauty of things or the cleverness of things or the comedy of things. But anyway, that's another discussion.
Indeed. One fun fact for you. I was familiar with Graham Chapman's work prior to ever being a Pythons fan, because my favorite band in the whole world, as you full well know, Iron Maiden, he appears in their music video for Can I Play With Madness. It was like his last ever acting gig, and I was very familiar with that music video before I ever knew who the Pythons were. And then the second link to Iron Maiden, they finish every single one of their gigs with Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, played through the sound system. So too many of the greatest moments of my being have all taken place while that song plays, as, you know, 20 or 30,000 sweaty people stumble out of a venue, elated.
Yes, it's a very good song. If you're feeling rotten or something you've forgotten, it's just, you know, an immortal series of lines, isn't it? One other anecdote. I'm quite interested by the fact that you do like it and it was immediate, because we recently introduced somebody who will be nameless, but is in fact Mr. Johnson of 22 Acacia Avenue, Liverpool. That, by the way, is a Monty Python sketch. We introduced Monty Python to somebody, a young man, and we were all there, and the whole crowd of the family was sitting round this unfortunate man while we looked at him, waited for his reactions, and he did not get it at all. This is the life of this is the Holy Grail. It meant nothing to him. And it was a moment, actually, of deep embarrassment and awkwardness. So we went on to Bill and Ted, and he really enjoyed that. So I wondered if, and we'll discuss the question of whether we're still a Python worshipping country later, but, you know, I wondered whether it's got lost with the younger generation.
I guess it's possible that I was bouncing off the energy of friends who were already excited by it, and then was within a group that wanted to discuss the sketches, rewatch them over and over, find all the, because there's so many jokes happening so quickly one after the other. It's very rewatchable, and you can pick up on different aspects of it. So maybe it was that kind of collective viewing, which helped. But I don't know. I appreciate that kind of humor anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, this young man was under enormous pressure. I'm sorry, I seem to be slipping into a sort of fake Yorkshire accent. I'd like to formally apologize for that. I think it might be the Python influence.
David, who's your favorite Python?
This is a very good question, and I pondered it long and I pondered it hard. I think the thing about the Pythons is that they work together as a team. I saw a documentary on them, which was deeply disappointing, because it seems that they didn't really like each other that much. Then that's the wrong thing. So they did like each other. But comedy, it's hard work, isn't it, by all accounts? Rowan Atkins always says that, doesn't he? And I think their creative energy had some stones in it, and that produced the oyster. Some grit, a better word. I think John Cleese always felt a bit superior to everybody else, and they thought he was a bit of an arrogant what's it. So there were friendships, but it wasn't all plain sailing and fun. So that's one answer to the question. Is I'm not sure I prefer any one of them, because they are a group, I think, and they didn't exist without all of them. But if you forced me against the wall and threatened a bit knife point, I think Terry Jones.
That was my answer as well.
Yes, because he's a thoroughly nice man. And, you know, he loves his history too. And he's done some quite good things, I think, on medieval history. So, yeah. Why do you like him most?
Well, obviously, in addition to him being a lovely man, I find myself laughing more consistently at his performance, almost regardless of what's happening. He just has a very funny face and a very funny voice. I just go to him first. My second is probably Eric Idle.
He's very good too.
I very consistently laugh at almost anything Eric Idle does in the Pythons. And then I guess the third one I put down is that Michael Palin is just a really nice chap.
He is. Actually, I saw a very interesting, I don't know if this should stay in, but I saw a very interesting edition of Staged. Have you seen that?
No.
You should see it. It's a lockdown thing where David Tennant and Martin Sheen play out trying to do a play. And anyway, watch it. It's good. And one day they're joined by Michael Palin, who, when the producer has gone, is incredibly rude to both of them. And it was an absolute shock. You know, you just don't imagine Michael Palin being nasty to anybody. And that was very funny, actually. It worked really well. Staged. You should watch it.
Oh, but he was being nasty as part of the joke of the show rather than...
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yes.
Sorry, I was like, you broke my heart. What are you doing?
Yes, I know.
Okay, David, since we've been talking about the Flying Circus, what would be your top three sketches?
Okay, my top three sketches. So I did some extensive research on this, actually, watching a whole load of things on YouTube, although I think the rights owners are closing them down a bit. I've got more than three. First one is the Four Yorkshiremen, mm-hmm. and it's not actually really a Python sketch. It's got some non-Pythons in it, whose name I've forgotten for a moment. But we used to repeat that in the playground absolutely constantly until, you know, Lord knows. So everything had to be, we had to lick the rod clean with tongue every morning sort of thing.
So is that the one where they live in the cardboard box or in the drain pipe?
That's it. Cardboard luxury. Yes.
Yeah, very good sketch.
Very good sketch, because we're always being told by our parents that when I was that age about the war and how lucky we were to, you know, to have Brussels sprouts, which, you know, we didn't believe, obviously. But so what about your first one? That's one from me. What about one from you?
Maybe it's an obvious one, but I always immediately think of the upper class tweet of the year, which is obviously the one that I sent you. Fondly remember it from a first viewing.
It is very good, actually. It links also to an element of Python. There's, despite the fact they're all pretty well healed, there is a definitely an anti-establishment vibe to the whole thing, isn't it? Because they also did an appeal from the super rich or something, which is also very funny.
I can't remember that one. I'll have to go watch more.
Yeah, look it up. It's quite a late thing, I think. It's very funny.
What were the other ones that you selected?
Okay, so my second favourite, I think, is the Philosophers football match.
Ah, that's brilliant. Okay, that's really good.
Very good.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yes, very good. Anyway, yes, so what about your second best?
I have a really soft spot for Olympic hide and seek.
Oh, I didn't think I've seen that. I must look for that.
It's not, I wouldn't, maybe it's not even that funny, but something about the concept of it just makes me laugh so much.
Yes, I'm laughing. I've never seen it. I'm laughing at the concept.
Like it lasts for over a year and then he finds him in a cave in like Sicily. I think they start in Piccadilly Circus and he covers his eyes and has to count to 60 and the other guy just runs and jumps on a bus. And then there's so many...
oh dear, very good. I mean, I can imagine. I can absolutely...
And there are so many shots of the guy who's the seeker, just like opening bin cans, just like bins randomly around the world, like looking for him.
Oh dear, that sounds fantastic. I should look that up immediately.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Very, very good. And then I was a bit torn about the third one. I showed the Battle of Pearl Harbor, which I thought was very funny just because it was so basic. But maybe the fish slapping dance.
Mm.
Because I don't know, it's just so utterly, I don't know, bizarre and out of place. I don't know, I just love that.
I went for Bicycle Repairman.
I don't know that one either.
Yeah, it's the one where Michael Palin is a superhero, but his only skill is that he can repair bikes.
That's an excellent concept too, because you know we always have that discussion. You know, I don't know if you have it, but I have it with plenty of people. Say, what would your special power be?
So there's,
I don't think,
and in the sketch, there's this guy riding his bike, and you know when they speed up the footage, and he crashes, and his bike's broken, and then it goes, "Quick, bicycle repair man!" And then he dashes in, repairs the bike, and then the guy's off again.
Oh dear, excellent. Fantastic. Actually, we haven't mentioned the big one I meant to mention was The Novelist. Have you come across that?
What happens in it?
What happens is there's a whole stadium and you can hear the crowd roar, and it's about local lad Thomas Hardy has come to write a novel in front of the crowd, and they give the whole commentary thing as he tries to write Jude the Obscure or something like that. He's gone for the... Oh, no, he's crossed it out. It's very funny.
If I was going to do a fourth one, it was The Granny Gang. That one I really remember.
Yes. They do love the whole granny dressing up as women thing, don't they? And it's got to be said, the women weren't really their greatest thing, wasn't it? But they did love the dressing up.
And then I guess, I don't know, a fifth one just to throw it in, because I forgot it before, but I love the Spam sketch. And I'm always thinking about Spam-de-Spam, the wonderful Spam.
And that was another one that went around the playground when we were always talking about Spam. The other one that related to that was the one with Pork, and I couldn't find it again, where it's not the quiz show Pork one, but it's another one where they're sitting on a sofa and they keep saying pork. Then eventually he asks her a question and she says, pork? And she says, why did you say pork? I panicked. And the concept of panicking and the fact that you're panicking makes you say pork, I just sound very funny.
I don't think I've seen that one. I'll have to look it up.
I couldn't find it. Anyway, we should get on with The Legend of Arthur, shouldn't we?
Well, take us away, David. You're doing the Holy Grail, all right?
The Holy Grail, Monty Python. And so it was made in 1975. It has a rating on the aggregator shows like Rotten Tomato so of 97%. 8.2 on IMDb, pretty good. It came after the Flying Circus series started in 1969, apparently. Four series, although the last one was a truncated one because John Cleese had left. So it was the second of their films, actually, but I've never seen the first film, which is kind of a collection of sketches, I think. Quite different. And in a way, Monty Python and the Holy Grail is a series of sketches held together by a central idea, isn't it? I mean, its key thing is obviously a succession of gags with this theme. So the story is, of course, that follows the Arthurian legends. They're out to find the Grail, and they come across a whole load of obstacles in their ways, of course. And it follows the format of an Arthurian legend. You know, they have challenges and they have to overcome those challenges, which is very Chrétien de Troyes sort of format. But the challenges are completely ridiculous. So I think you posed the question, Wolf, but I'll ask it to you. Which of the trials in the quest of the Holy Grail would be your undoing?
Interesting. I mean, I think arguably any of them you could... I mean, I don't think I would survive many of them. But I think my answer was that I would probably fall foul to the rabbit, because the rabbit is the toughest. Then I remembered there's the cave monster, so I thought, okay, actually, maybe the cave monster's harder. Right. But yeah. I thought I probably couldn't defeat the rabbit. But I think maybe most realistic is I ultimately would perish on the bridge of death, yes, flounder over a very simple question.
Absolutely. What is your favorite color? Wolf?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't. Whatever. Yeah. If they gave me harder questions, I might survive. But if they gave me a simple question that's like a choice of preference,
you'd be dead.
Jettisoned.
Who was it? Was it Robin who said pink? No. Was that Robin? Anyway, one of them did that, didn't they?
Yeah. Two of them die, don't they? I have a feeling that Michael Palin might go off as well.
Yes. It's like, actually, I can't remember.
Blue. No, yes, green.
That's it. That's delightful. In fact, one of the funniest things about the entire film is just Michael Palin saying, "I seek the Grail at the Bridge of Death." Actually, for some reason, that absolutely cracks me up. The challenge that I would have failed at most was from the knights who until recently said knee. And I've spent quite a lot of time actually wondering about how you would go about cutting down a tree with a herring. Now, obviously, they did deny that challenge as just silly, but, you know. So I don't know what more you want me to say about the movie, really, as a movie. It is, I mean, the thing about the film is that it's just, you said about going back to Python over and over again, and that's the thing about all of this, it seems to me, is that the Holy Grail, you can just go back and back and back and see other things, or just laugh at the way they do it. You know, the coconuts thing is just, you know, constantly funny. The way when his horse gets shot by an arrow, falls down and says, "Message for you, sir," and then dies because he's got an arrow in his chest. You know, the fabric of it, just every second is kind of funny. There's funny stuff there. But anyway, yes, the funniest sketch. I can't ever get away from come and see the violence inherent in the system.
Yeah.
You know, Dennis, the anarchist, is enormously funny. But then there's the holy hand grenade of Antioch, you know, mm-hmm. The number of the counting, two thou shalt not count until you, unless thou then proceedeth to three. Five is right out. I mean, it's just...
Yep. The discussion of the orangutans and then the breakfast cereals.
So, I mean, it's just... There's so much in it. And of course, part of it also, I think, is why I wonder about whether it retains its relevance, is that quite a lot of it feeds into a shared experience I have. So we have a mate we work on for Things That Made England, and he doesn't like Python. He says it's a bunch of posh guys. Well, I am, unfortunately, a posh guy. But one of the things that I had, they don't have to be posh to go to Sunday school, of course. And that quite religious language, that quasi-religious language, and those, you know, all those lectures you had at Sunday school, or I had at Sunday school, that religious language they find very funny. And that's the reason why the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch is just absolutely cracks me up, because it takes him back to Sunday school.
Well, I was going to, if you wanted to ask me what my favorite sketch was.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you'd said yes.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Go on.
Well, I guess it's because I wrote down too many answers, but I just had to say that I absolutely love the historian who crops up randomly in the movie. And then my favorite bit is when he gets killed by that knight.
Right, the knight who comes to. That does my head in, actually. That's the one criticism I have on the film, funnily enough. So it's interesting you like it. The thing about the film that I found a bit distressing, and maybe I'm just too literal, is the fact that I don't think they know how to end. And I don't like that historian bit and the dropping in and out of time. Because for me, what makes it so funny, partly, is that they do this thing utterly seriously. You know, they never say to each other, "You realize we're not on horses, we've just got coconuts." They never say that to each other or let on. They're completely serious about it. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so funny. And therefore, this historian time shift thing and the end where they get all arrested just messes that up for me. So it's fascinating that you like that.
Well, see, I was going to ask you, how do you feel about the ending? Because I don't like the ending with the police. I find it dissatisfying.
Yes, very dissatisfying.
But I separate the historian from... I can see the connection, but to me, I view it more as we're being presented with this really silly story, and then it's given additional credence by this interjection the historian, who is very seriously analyzing what's happening. So I find that very funny. Obviously, it doesn't make any sense, but I think it's just, admittedly, the bit I laugh about the most is when the historian, when you realize everything meshes and the historian gets killed by the knight, and then it's when his wife's like screams his name and like rushes to his body. I don't know why. I just find that very funny. Also, just...
What does that say about you, Wolf?
Yeah, I don't know.
Don't think about that too hard.
But yeah, I don't know. To me, I can still enjoy the historian, even though I don't enjoy the ending.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting we agree about the ending as well. So shall I talk very briefly about the legend, the historicity of it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, actually, there are plenty of articles around saying, hey, it's not as unhistorical as you think. There really were horses made of coconuts. No, they don't say that. But the myth of Arthur is itself a series of different myths. And I know people say, for example, that people reinvent Shakespeare for the purposes of their own time. And so Henry the Fifth, for example, in the war and the Kenneth Branagh one. And the legend of Arthur is very similar, actually. The very first mentions are around the 5th and 6th century BC, which is earlier than most of the medieval legends we're used to. And the first, then in the 9th century, you get the Latin History of Britain, Historia Britonium, by a Welsh monk called Nennius, mentions a warlord called Arthur. He fought 12 battles against invaders, including the big one at Mons Badonicus, which actually gets a mention in the Holy Grail. And actually, interestingly, if there is an Arthur, he probably appears in an odd 50-year hiatus in the record of the Anglo-Saxon advance into Britain, around about 530-ish, for about 50 years. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle doesn't record any advances, and people have built theories around that, saying that maybe a real Arthur won this battle at Mons Badonicus and held the invaders back for 50 years, and maybe the legend grows up around that. But the big break, Arthur's big break, came under a chap called Geoffrey of Monmouth, who wrote a book called Historia Regum Britanniae, which is a massively good book, which you need to read. Not just for the Arthur stuff, actually, but also apparently Brutus founded Britain. And it's barking mad, but people believed it. So actually, Geoffrey of Monmouth's history was very much accepted and used by various kings, actually, to justify various actions. But it's a very different kind of Arthur to the one we're used to, and the one we're used to was really invented by a chap called a French poet called Chrétien de Troyes, who wrote a number of Arthurian romances in the 12th century.
Is that Gawain and the Green Knight?
No, Gawain and Green Knight is a 13th century Middle English poem, actually, as it happens, but it kind of does the same thing that follows the sort of format of Chrétien de Troyes, these challenges, this the tradition of courtly love, the things that we imagine about Arthur, the pavilion and the people coming to challenge them to battle, the Black Knight thing in the Holy Grail, you know, when he says just scratch, all that sort of stuff, which again has been reenacted on playgrounds all over England for, you know, decades. And then there's a 15th century Thomas Malory, the Mort d'Arthur, who collected all these ideas and these stories into one place. And, you know, there's been countless other adaptations since. So there was one by, what's his name, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking, Guy Ritchie, quite recently as well. So it's absolutely sunk in that tradition of the legend of Arthur, and all those tropes come up. But it's in the historical romance version, probably more than the original early medieval tradition. Fun enough, at the beginning of the film, they give a date, and now I'm struggling to remember what it is, but I think it was 936.
I think it's 932 AD.
932, okay, 932 AD, which is a very odd date, and it's always worried me, because nothing happened in 932. I'm pretty sure it's during the reign of Athelstan, and nothing happened, and it's far too late for any potential historical Arthur. It's far too early for really the kind of the get-up they have, although they do have mail rather than plate armour, so that's kind of probably most people would have been wearing mail in warriors would have been wearing mail. But then you wouldn't have the knight thing, because knights were... I mean, there is a tradition of knights in English history, but a knight was a companion of a lord. It's not quite that same Arthurian romance thing, which is a bit like, which comes from Chrétien de Troyes. So it's in the tradition of Chrétien de Troyes, I think, rather than, as I said, the earlier things. And you've got all those things like the padarm, so quests and challenges, as we've said. Robin and his minstrels, you know, which again always makes me laugh. You know, when danger reared its ugly head, he bravely turned his tail and head. He bravely turned his tail and fled. Classic stuff. But that's kind of historical. You know, minstrels are a very important part of a knight's companions, as it were. The depiction of medieval life is kind of... Well, I've got some pros and cons to it. Obviously, there was recurrent plague in the Middle Ages, and there were famines which killed countless numbers of people. On the other hand, we see medieval life in much more miserable terms than it would actually have been like. If you want to know what the real Middle Ages were, when people really were murdered for no reason, it's the early modern Europe is what you're looking for. So I'm a bit in two minds about that. So anyway, the thing is, it is part of a tradition and it uses all those tropes. Mm-hmm. And there are things in it which you can say, that's kind of historical. But of course, in the main, it's absurd.
Is there any evidence of someone building a castle and it falling down, and building another castle and then that falling down?
Well, yes, interesting enough. In the Geoffrey of Monmouth version, that's what Vortigern does. He builds a castle in the swamp, and Merlin appears in the story because he wants to know why it keeps falling down. So he asks this wizard, Merlin, who turns up and said, it's because two dragons, a red and a white dragon, are fighting underneath the swamp. Something like that. I may have garbled it slightly. But yes, absolutely. Vortigern is king of all Britain and seen as a sort of an evil king. And the white and the red dragon fight. And I think the white gets defeated by the red, and the red is the Welsh dragon. So, yes. But he wasn't a Yorkshireman. And he didn't cost them £50 each for a guardsman.
That whole sketch is actually one of my favorites in the whole movie. And I was just fondly remembering when his son is scaling down the tower on the rope and he goes over and just cuts it. And then you get that nice little 10-second pause where you're waiting for the sound.
That's very good. Well, also, he shoots an arrow out of the window, which is one of my favorite bits. Yes. Where I said, message for you, sir.
Also, he barely pulls the string back while he's looking the wrong way.
Yes.
And it goes, and right. It's a real classic doink, and it just pops out the window.
Very good. And of course, the classic, I'm not dead yet. He is now, sir. Anyway, yes, very good. So what is your favourite sketch then of the film?
Well, I probably have to agree with you. It really is Dennis. And it's, but I like every aspect of it. The slow build up of the scene. When obviously he opens by calling him an old woman. He's like, man.
Yes.
Yes. You could have called me Dennis.
Oh dear, yes. And it is an absolute classic. Yeah, I agree.
Right, shall we move on to Life of Brian?
Yes. Let's move on to Life of Brian.
Okay, so Life of Brian, which was made in 1979, follows the hapless Brian Cohen, a Jewish Roman boy born on the same day next door to Jesus, who then gets mistaken for the Messiah and attempts to escape the spotlight and the Romans. David, what do you think of the film?
Well, as I say, when I saw it with Dan, we just howled. And there are so many funny things in it. I think the differences with Life of Brian and The Holy Grail is that it has a coherence as a film that The Holy Grail doesn't have. And also it has a message that The Holy Grail is just pure silliness with some just absolutely grade-A bulletproof sketches. The Life of Brian has this quite interesting thing about, you know, belonging and hypocrisy and, you know, religion, that sort of thing, which the Holy Grail doesn't have. So there's the lovely bit, isn't there? In, you know, the famous, the second funniest line in the British language, where he comes out and everybody says, the Messiah, and his mum comes out and says he's not the Messiah, he's just a very naughty boy.
Yeah, it's very good.
Good. So in that scene, you've also got Brian saying to everybody, look, you're all individuals. And then somebody cries from the back, I'm not.
The bit where everyone in unison goes, we're all individual.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's an edge to The Life of Brian, which The Holy Grail hasn't got.
Yes. What's your favourite? What, is that your favourite joke in the movie or your favourite sketch?
Well, it is the second best line in British comedy. I don't know that it's not my favourite bit, though.
Mm-hmm.
My favourite bit, but again, this is about shared experience with the Pythons, is the Romans go home bit on the wall.
Yes.
And that bit makes me laugh so hard that a little wee comes out every time. And it is because of the shared pain as a grammar school boy of doing Latin at school and the complete pain of doing Latin and the incomprehensibility of Latin as a language. What's all this then? Romanos ain't domus. People called Romanos, they go to the house. I mean, it just, you know, as he says that, a whole flood of memories of pain, fear, and distress. In my O-level exam, I had rocks coming down from hills because I could only ever translate nouns. And so I just had to link these nouns to each other. I could never work out all the verb declension stuff. Was incomprehensible. And apparently it was a pastoral scene. I've never understood how I got a C because I knew nothing. So that is my favourite. But I suppose if you haven't done Latin, I don't know, is it as funny? Did you do Latin?
No, I didn't. But I can understand from doing French and Spanish, I can understand the theory behind it. It's a very smart joke. It's
very
smart. Very smart.
God, I love.
I always find myself going to some of the silliest jokes. Those are always bits I remember the most. It is very funny when they subdivide into the gourd and the sandal factions.
Yes.
That is very funny. And I always love the old man and the juniper bush.
The old man in the
juniper. Well, no, the old man in the hole. You know, it all happens in the same scene.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah. Where he's like, I haven't spoken in 18 years, and they think it's a miracle. Like, that scene is so very good. On this rewatch, I had particular enjoyment from the opening scene when the three wise men arrive. Especially when Brian's mum is asking what his star sign is. And during the conversation, one of the wise men goes, he's the son of God. He's the king of the Jews. And then she goes, oh, that's Capricorn, is it?
I'm sorry, I also like the bit when they come back in and they just take the presents back and shove Mrs. Bryan into it. I mean, just, yeah. I don't know. That's
and when she's like, oh, come back anytime, but maybe next time don't bother bringing the myrrh.
That's very, very funny. There are lots of little bits. So, I don't know, donation for an ex-leper, sir? Ex-leper? Oh, he came and cured me, took my job away with that. But Simon should have, by your leave. You know, it's that lovely thing about being able to see things from the other end of the telescope, that maybe a leper made his, who made his liver, his living by begging, would have been a bit in a bit of a hole if Jesus came along and cured him. But actually, the best thing in the whole thing has got to be, blessed are the cheesemakers.
Yes. Honestly, David, every time I'm at any gig, large event, anything with a public speaker, in my mind I'm always thinking, and I often say, wait, did he say blessed are the cheesemakers?
Oh, dear. And then the guy from the Sanhedrin or whatever he's from saying, well, no, I don't think he means, I think he probably means purveyors of all dairy products. And that just takes me straight back to Sunday school and the Reverend Walters giving me a sermon about the meaning of the Bible. Oh, dear.
And then when they get onto the meek and they're like, oh, the poor meek, they do have a tough time.
Well, it's nice they've got something.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Oh, God.
It's fantastic. Very good. And then the last thing that I always particularly enjoy is when the, presumably he's a slave, survives the battle with the gladiator. And then when he wins, he runs around doing the football celebrations when he gets on the floor on his knees and then puts his arm up. And the whole crowd's cheering. Oh, I think I'm having a cardiac arrest.
Oh, dear, it's just absolutely. I mean, also, the throw him to the floor. Sorry, sir. Throw him to the floor. All right, sir.
It's gold from start to finish. Every single
absolutely,
joke.
It absolutely is.
And this is what going to the pub is like. You just sit there and you talk through all of your favorite bits. You could go through the haggling.
Yes.
10 for that, you must be mad.
Yes, that's very good indeed as well, yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I mean, you're right. This is the thing about both films, that you just, oh, it's just stuffed full of gags, and you can go on forever repeating these bloody gags. It's absolute gold. Absolute gold.
So I think it should be noted when talking about this film, and I wanted to gauge your memories of this. You already mentioned that you think it had an 18 rating when it came out. So the film was banned in some places upon release, or was given an X rating in 39 local authorities in the UK. I even read that some local authorities banned it, even though they didn't have any cinemas in those local authorities and had never seen it. They just went on word of mouth. I think it was banned in Ireland for 8 years, and it was banned in Norway for 1 year. And then Sweden sold the movie that it was, they used the fact that Norway had banned it as positive marketing. To be like, I don't know, so controversial that Norway banned this. Come and see this film in Sweden. But it was a box office sensation.
It's got to be pretty. It's got to be pretty controversial, surely, for Norway to ban it. Aren't they the center of reason and light, Scandinavian countries?
Well, I can't quite tell if you're making a joke.
No, I'm not. We all love the Scandis, don't we?
Yeah.
Don't we all love Scandinavia?
No, I do.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, I just thought it was... I always knew that it was controversial, and I remember that TV interview, the famous one.
Oh, yes. God, the thing with Malcolm Muggeridge.
Yeah.
Being unbelievably pompous and up himself. And here is a man that, certainly at the time, when I was relatively young, but even I had heard of Malcolm Muggeridge and how incredibly respected he was. I don't know anything about him, to be honest, but, you know, very respected, very intellectual. And he was made to look and sound like a complete arse. A complete arse. You just thought, this guy is an idiot.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, we couldn't be doing with it. I mean, our age, we just thought this is just silly. You know, this is even more daft than being told Brussels are edible.
Well, I wonder how much it played into the success of the movie and how much this controversy like helped build, you know, no publicity is bad publicity.
Yeah, it might have been. Might well have been. Well, certainly everybody was talking about it. I mean, it always seemed to me that it wasn't, in a sense, the Pythons were disingenuous in saying it wasn't disrespectful towards Jesus, although it isn't. You know, there's no insults about Christianity per se. But it is disrespectful about religion or about some of the things that happen in religion. And obviously, you know, there's a close parallel. I can understand why, you know, deeply religious people might be upset by it, I suppose.
Yeah. Interestingly, I was reading that Muggeridge and the other guy, they were late to the screening of the movie they went to watch, and they came in 15 minutes late and they missed the opening scene, which, and all the scenes with Jesus. So you realize that Brian and Jesus are separate individuals. So they right. thought that the movie was equating them both into one figure and thus completely, right. you know, destroying the figure of Jesus, which very revealing, very angry about something you've never watched.
Yes.
So there was that, but sorry.
You've reminded me of the crucifixion process. Crucifixion, yes. One cross each, first on the left. Oh, no, I've been let off. Oh, have you? Who? Oh, congratulations. Nah, just joking. Oh, dear. Fantastic. And then the song, of course. You mentioned the song, you know. Because your Iron Maiden experience,
yeah,
of them playing Always Look on the Bright Side of Death.
It's a great song.
If you're feeling rotten, there's something you've forgotten. That's to laugh and dance and sing.
Yeah, was it? Life's pretty shit when you think of it.
Yes. Yes. Very good indeed. So, yes, I mean, the controversy. I mean, it faded. I don't know how long it lasted. It's a bit of a storm in teacup, I suppose, but...
So you didn't.
I'll never forget the pomposity of Malcolm Muggeridge. It did him for me for the rest of, you know.
And did you see Mary Whitehouse on the news picketing some of the cinemas that screened it?
Mary Whitehouse is very funny. We really enjoyed Mary Whitehouse actually at the time. She was a real hoot. I mean, I wouldn't give either of them the rough end of a pineapple, and we wouldn't then.
No, but yeah, it was an incredibly successful movie. I think I read that it was the fourth highest grossing film in the UK that year, and it was the highest grossing British film in the US. And then just in general terms, this film regularly now tops any poll of the greatest comedies of all time. It's respected by audiences and critics alike. Don't need to go into that much more. The point of the film was it's very interesting, like you were saying, compared to Holy Grail. This film has a lot of things that it wants to satirize, a lot of point of views that it wants to get out there. And I was reading about the kind of culture of 70s Britain at the time and how that they were very aware of the left-wing political groups, trade unions, guerrilla organizations. And that's a big influence for how they take them down in the film, as well as lampooning, you know, modern organized religion in this kind of heretical attack on the church and different people's interpretations of belief.
Mm.
So, I think maybe the reason it resonates, well, we'll talk about this later. I would argue that it perhaps stands The Test of Time better than Holy Grail, because so much of the parody still has resonance now.
Yes. Although it's a little bit out of date, isn't it? In the sense that, you know, that all that, I don't know, maybe this is wrong. All that, I was going to say, all that left-wing communist factionalism kind of disappeared. I would have thought the more, you know, the bigger target now is, I don't know, neoliberalism or whatever it might be. But, I mean, I suppose there's factionalism in everything, isn't there? You know, it's a universal theme.
I think different groups will come along, and each of those groups, you can see them in the different organizations being taken down. So there's a kind of universalness to the comedy. In terms of history, obviously, we know the film is parody. We can't really seriously interrogate them as like historical representations, but it is very fun. And I read a lot of like theological articles about the kind of about the history and the kind of impact of this film and how much people are still talking about it now. Obviously, it's based on biblical texts, religious traditions, and then interesting, which I hadn't at first considered, it's fully aware of all the kind of biblical movies that Hollywood has been producing in the sort of 80 years prior to this. And a lot of the referencing going on is, I mean, the Spartacus reference, I'm Brian and so's my wife. I mean,
it's a killer, isn't it?
It's an absolute killer. It's very good. So they were incredibly aware of the of general perceptions of kind of modern understandings of this kind of time period from all those biblical epics that we'd had, you know, Ben-Hur, Spartacus, etc. And they kind of raise a lot of that up to kind of tear it down. So as I went through, generally from what I was reading, and maybe this is people being too generous, but it does create a semi-convincing sense of place and is packed with a lot of little details and casual references. It's helpful having, you know, discussions of Latin and references, jokes made about the Assyrian Empire. It was filmed in Tunisia to replicate the Holy Land. So there's some attempt there. I was reading that stoning was a form of capital punishment in the Jewish criminal code. And it would have been very popular. But I read one article that claimed there were no examples of stoning as punishment for blasphemy and no evidence that women would have been excluded from attending. And this article raised the suggestion that what the film is referencing more is the general perception of Jewish violence and the marginalization of women that might have been perceived at this time in the 70s.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting. If they were like, it doesn't come from historical records, but it comes from stereotyping. That's kind of where those references are coming from. Then I looked through, well, you know, what the Romans had done for us. I was like, did the Romans really do all of that?
So, you know, that is one of that is the one joke in the whole film that I have actually learned to find a bit irritating, because that is so all pervasive. What have the Romans ever done for us? Or what has X, insert names applicable, ever done for us? And I've just heard that too many times now. I'm sorry, I don't want to bring up a negative, but
I won't repeat it. But I went through a big long article about this and a few other things. So I thought it was fun. So the Romans didn't invent the aqueducts, but go ahead, David.
What were they built? The aqueducts actually built before the Romans arrived.
Well, obviously, everyone come out there and correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, because I am trying to squash this research down. I was under the impression that aqueducts had been invented before, but that they weren't widely distributed until the Romans came along, because it was such a pervasive kind of part of Roman construction, and was distinctive to their civilization. So they definitely bought aqueducts, around with them, but they didn't necessarily come up with them.
No, I can quite well believe that being correct.
They also get praised for their roads, which obviously we all recognize. But one of the counterpoints I was reading is that the Roman roads were generally military roads and generally long distance roads. So in local networks, like in and around Judea, there wouldn't have been Roman roads. People would still have been walking on their own local networks that they'd come up with. But, you know, we do casually recognize them as incredible road builders. The baths did come from the Romans. And then I was reading that obviously they didn't invent wine, but they did bring a lot of wine from other parts of Europe with them. So that would have been something that had been brought to that new land. But just in general, I think we can all assume that for the point of the joke, it's to go a bit over the top. And I don't think we're really meant to believe that they genuinely bought irrigation, medicine, education, health, public safety to the people of Judea. It's such a like hyperbolic statement to suggest that none of this was there prior.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was worth pointing that out.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And are they really able to hide as cleverly in Judea as they do in the film when the an entire century of Roman soldiers comes to hide, to search one small room?
And there's that one place they didn't check. What's so fun about the film is that it can have this joke, which is about how advanced the Roman civilization is, and look at everything they've given to all these people. And then at the same time, the, you know, the Romans are all blithering idiots. They can't figure anything out. They find a spoon when they can't track down all these people. Like, every single person in this movie is a fool.
Yes.
No one is safe.
Yes, how did they conquer the world? Yes.
A couple of last points, really, really quick. Clothing-wise, Pilate, yes, would have worn a toga. But I was reading that a lot of Jewish authority figures would not have worn high, elaborate headwear, except during temple ritual. But this is something that happens in almost all biblical films in order to, I guess, show an audience members quickly who's Jewish. They create this kind of stereotypical outfit for them, and then they're always presented in that fashion, even though it's unrealistic. There was no Colosseum in Jerusalem, as we all know.
I suppose. Good point.
So, you know, they put it in because they want to reference the game. So they incorporate a bunch of this stuff in, but that's not accurate. And then I was reading an interesting discussion that the depiction of Judea in this film, with its troop garrisons, anti-Roman sentiment and oppression, is more representative of 60s Judea than 30s Judea. And that a lot of that came about with Nero's reign. So I could be wrong on this, but it's under the impression...
That is very specific, Wolf.
I was under the impression that... Because this film's set in, like, 33... I think it is.
Oh, I suppose it is, I suppose. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's set in 33, but I think the main anti-Roman sentiment comes about in Nero's reign because he was particularly horrible.
There we go. Very interesting.
So, yeah, it's the same thing you were saying with Holy Grail. A lot of the articles are like, I read one. Actually, I'll come to it now. So in 2014, there was a conference at King's College London called the Jesus and Brian Conference. Yep. John Cleese and Terry Jones attended alongside a number of the most prominent religious figures and theologians of the world. They convened in London and had this like 3-day conference about Jesus and Brian.
Yeah, academics are as weird as religious sects, aren't they? And they really are utterly bonkers.
And it was fascinating. I was reading so much about this. And there was a lot of really interesting stuff, and they discussed how the film has aided in the study of the New Testament. And I've seen some articles from theological professors who talk about how this film is like what unlocks like theology to their students, or the thing that they most respond to when taught at university. But one of the quotes that I got from this article was that at this conference, there was praise for aspects of the film's historical accuracy and a recognition that it surpassed the level typical of the biblical genre at the time, portraying some contextual aspects surprisingly well. And some of these aspects were the multifaceted depiction of empire and the differential social hierarchy. And then overall, the conference basically just argued that the Pythons inspired this trend of questioning scholarly presumptions, as well as highlighting the problems of interpretation of a sort of 2,000-year divide. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. I think if you really want to read into the movie, you can. but also you can completely dismiss everything.
Indeed, yes. And did this conference discuss whether Roman centurions said throw him to the floor?
I didn't see it come up, but I'm sure over the 3 days, because I read a very abridged version, it must have come up.
Did they discuss how many angels you can get on a head of a pin? Good Lord. Anyway, there you go.
To know how much fun I was having with my history research, I didn't actually go through with this, but during my planning, I wrote down, just double check, did incontinentia buttocks exist?
And did you check if incontinentia buttocks did exist or not?
No, I didn't. I felt too silly.
Yes, I think if you start Googling incontinentia buttocks, you might get arrested. You've got to watch that.
Okay, so just to sum up, David, really quick. Yes. Which one of the two films is least unhistorical?
Oh, I think Life of Brian is least unhistorical, because at least it builds a framework, which is probably reasonably accurate.
Yeah, and it has some real people in it.
Yeah, whereas the Holy Grail is bonkers.
Which one has the most laughs?
That's such a hard question. I don't know. I waver over this one.
Which one's your favorite?
I don't know. Sometimes it's the Holy Grail. Sometimes it's the Life of Brian. I think the Life of Brian is a better made film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more professional, it's more coherent, and there are just as many gags. But something about the Holy Grail, I love it. I love that there is no point. It's just joyous sketches and gags for the sake of joyous sketches and gags. And I love Dennis more than life itself. So I think I'm probably going to go for Holy Grail, but if you ask me tomorrow, I'll go for Life of Brian.
No, I feel the same way. I think that from a neutral perspective, Life of Brian is the better film, but my favorite is probably The Holy Grail.
Yeah, it seems we're ending up. I have a question for you, Wolf.
Okay.
Maybe the last thing we discuss, which is there is a Not the 9 o'clock News sketch, which I sent you, I believe. I think the Not the 9 o'clock News were during the 90s. Very popular sketch show, very funny indeed. Rowan Atkinson, the chap who was in Colin's Sandwich, Mel Smith, Pamela Anderson. Fantastic show. And they did this lovely sketch where they sort of aped the Malcolm Muggeridge interview, but they switched it around. So instead of being about, this film, Life of Brian is a skit on Jesus Christ. They said, this film is obviously a skit on our hero, Brian, who this Jesus bloke comes into it. It was obviously supposed to be Brian, isn't it? An outrage. And it within the sketch is the line, should a film like this be allowed to be produced in a country that is ostensibly at least still a Python worshipping country? Which I thought was a very good and funny line. So, Wolf, the question I've got for you, are we still a Python worshipping country?
Okay. I struggled with this because I don't know many people who are younger than me, so I have no idea if it's still something that they come across and they're interested in. I think overall, though, I would argue that based on how well their tour sold out sort of 4 or 5 years ago and how popular the 40th anniversary of Life of Brian was, combined with the sense that I feel like we still regularly use the term like Python-esque to refer to any type of surreal comedy. And when I try and think of other comedy shows, even arguably, so Not the 9 o'clock News is like 20 years later. And that didn't really permeate through to me. I never really picked up on it when I was growing up.
Well, you'd have been 10, wouldn't you?
I was born in 90. When did they?
Yeah, so it would have been too early for you. You'd have been...
Yeah, but I
don't know.
I think what I mean is, like, I still came... Maybe it's because it's TV, which is different. And through the Pythons, I started with their movies. Mm. But even though I've watched all of Fawlty Towers, I guess Blackadder does pretty well. But I still think a lot of stuff that was coming out around the same time, it just doesn't seem to have the same impact anymore. It seems to have faded and it's remembered by slightly older generations. And whereas I still think that we can't reference surreal comedy now without everyone automatically thinking of the Pythons. So yeah. I would argue that we still are a Python worshipping country, but I do think it will change.
So you went to those reunions, you said, is that right?
Yeah, we got tickets and went to the O2.
That's it. And were they good?
Yeah, they were good. They did really good sketches, and they did all the songs, and you know, they did all your favorite songs, and they put them into big numbers with loads of dancers, and it was easy to, you know, it was a fun thing, but it's probably not worth the money. Like, you could just hang out with your mates in the pub and repeat all the same sketches. maybe that's being too dismissive.
Anyway, yeah.
But what I mean is, it's like they just want to do the hits, so they're going to do the hits, and you know all the jokes anyway, so you're laughing ahead of time at the gags you already know are coming.
So I took Millie to see, I'm going to ask you whether it's like this. I took Millie to see when she must have been 13, 14 or something. I took her to see The Stranglers in Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Nice.
Used to be, now the O2. And we sat upstairs, actually, because I was a bit worried about, you know, I mean, after all, Stranglers were pretty punky. Anyway, but they were ancient. And I looked over, at one stage, from the seats on the balcony down into the mush pit. And the mush pit was unlike a mush pit I remembered. I may have told you this anecdote before.
I don't think
but
so.
But rather than going up and down, as you know, mush pits are supposed to do, it kind of wobbled like a jelly because none of the people down there could get off the ground, essentially. And also the mush pit was grey because everybody had grey hair.
Ah.
Was it like that? I mean, was it full of old dudes?
Kind of. The trouble, though, it's London and it's an expensive event. It's a bit like when I saw the Stones in Hyde Park. Yeah. It's a lot of champagne glasses. Like, that's right. Even if I didn't see them, that's the impression I get. Mm. Like, you know, Pythons give a joke and everyone's like, ah, rah.
Jolly good show. So it was kind of like a bunch of old dudes remembering their youth, like the Stranglers concert in a way, but maybe because of the fortune,
I guess. I think,
for example, I didn't go to the Led Zeppelin reunion because it was something like £200 a ticket.
Yeah, and, well, I entered the lottery to try and, because you had to go into a lottery to get, and you could only get two tickets if you got picked at random. I attempted but didn't manage it. But I did see some of the members of Led Zeppelin. Did I ever told you this?
Well, because they sponsored the movies, didn't they?
Well, it was when I saw the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium. And Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones came on stage and they played.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic track then.
It was incredible. I cried.
Superb. Yes, you would do. You would do. I missed up on a chance to go and see them at Nebworth when I was 13.
Mm.
And I've regretted that ever since, essentially. Anyway, we've moved away from Python, haven't we? To the other gods. Okay, so we're still a Python worshiping country, but the religion has surely got to die out at some stage.
Ask the followers, see if everyone else still agrees.
We should have that discussion.
So do you think we should rate these movies or not? I ask because I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I mean, well, obviously they're stellar, aren't they? You know, 10 for quality as films and 10 for historical accuracy.
10s across the board.
Yes. In fact, 11s across the board.
Wait, do we have to do Spinal Tap next?
Yes, we have to do Spinal Tap. Yes, that we really ought to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Has a drummer ever spontaneously combusted on stage? I'll begin the research.
Very good. Okay. Well, I think we're done, aren't we?
Yep. Wolf? I'm back for something more serious next time.
Yes, obviously something a bit more serious. And I think actually we're going to do. Are we not? Are we going to do Zulu and Kingdom of Heaven?
Yes.
Isn't that what we're heading towards?
Yeah, now for something completely different.
Now for something completely different, yes, indeed. Anyway, good luck with Zulu. Right, so Thanks, everybody. Do come along to the Facebook site and comment. What is your favorite sketch? Are we still a Python worshipping country? How long will it be so? And air your views.
Yeah. Which is your favorite of the two movies?
Which is your favorite of the two movies?
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the topic, Wolf. And thanks very much to everybody for listening. Bye then.
Bye.
Are you not entertained?